I bought the dot-com companies. And I thought I was being safe because I bought the name brands, right? The Yahoos and EMCs and Sun Microsystems. I stayed away from the pets.com. So I thought I was being smart and safe. But then we all know what happened, right? All of these dropped 90%+ and then some.
Hello, fellow risk takers, and welcome to my worst investment ever. Stories of loss to keep you winning. In our community, we know that to win in investing, you must take risk, but to win big, you've got to reduce it. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm on a mission to help 1 million people reduce risk in their lives. And thank you for joining this mission, especially our listeners in sunny California. Fellow risk takers, this is your worst podcast host, Andrew Stotz from A Stotz Academy, and I'm here with featured guest, Jeff Sarti. Jeff, are you ready to join the mission?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
All right. Let me introduce you to the audience. Jeff, CEO of Morton Wealth, leads a firm managing over $3 billion in assets with a mission to empower better investors. Jeff helps clients achieve their financial goals while supporting employees in their career growth. A CFA charter holder, Jeff shares his insights through his Perspective newsletter. His expertise emphasizes challenging the status quo and fostering long-term resilient investment strategies. Jeff, take a moment and tell us about the unique value that you are bringing to this wonderful world.
Thanks for having me as a starting point. Been really looking forward to this. As a starting point, just to put in context, we're a wealth manager. And like many wealth managers, we're typically, you know, the financial quarterback in a client's life, helping them navigate all of the financial decisions they face in their life, from retirement to tax strategies, estate strategies, you name it. That being said, our real differentiation is on the investment side. We look very different. And I'm sure we'll talk about the strategy of how we look different. But more than anything, it starts with mindset. I know that's something that you talk a lot about in your podcasts and the books you write. Everything really is around your approach to investing and behavioral finance. And the term I like to use in terms of the type of clientele that we synergize with, it's a healthy skeptic. And maybe I'll start just even quickly saying what's not a healthy skeptic. You mentioned status quo in my bio. What's not a healthy skeptic, most people are just comfortable with the status quo, right? What's worked in the last 40 years should work in the next 40 years. You know, let's say a 60-40 stock bond portfolio. Nothing wrong with that. And most of our industry caters to that. And there's wonderful solutions for that type of mindset. That being said, for more of a skeptical mindset, our clients are typically, again, skeptics. They tend to be very smart. They're curious, they're questioning, and they don't take what's thrown at them at face value. And so that shows itself in a couple ways. One is with regards to the markets themselves, let's say the stock market. They have a lot of questioning and even some distrust of the stock market. Of course, they're going to invest in stocks, but to a lesser degree than most for a few reasons. They view the stock market somewhat as speculative game, even a casino. You look at like the meme stocks, things of that nature. They question valuations. You know, valuations to some degree have, we believe, somewhat untethered from fundamentals. And even just the rise of passive investing. Passive investment has been great in a lot of ways, but in so many ways, it's synonymous with mindless investing. And so I think they have a lot of skepticism or question around that. But even more importantly, I think around policies in general, they're skeptical. Government policies, this is really an offshoot of 2008 more than anything else. They question the imbalances, the extremities of 0% interest rates, money printing, and now in recent years, just the binge on debt, that where they believe that intuitively, maybe they're not economists or clients, but they intuitively believe that there's no free lunch. And that there's ultimately going to be a cost to these types of policies. And so as a result of that, they're looking for something different. They're looking to build more of a resilient portfolio. You talk so much about managing risk first and foremost. We and our clients strongly believe that. So that's the skeptical side. Now, I'll just finish on why a healthy skeptic. The danger of being a skeptic too much is you can veer into sort of doomsday land, right? And just want to be doom and gloom. Put your cash under a mattress, maybe shorting the market, long volatility, you name it. Easier said than done to pursue that strategy. I think a healthy skeptic, while they're cautious, they want to participate, right? They want to be invested. They want to be long the economy, the market, et cetera. They want to be in the game. But again, they want to do it in just a more thoughtful way than just a standard passive 60-40 portfolio. They want to build a more resilient portfolio. And that is the end result of this different mindset. It is a portfolio that looks meaningfully different, not to a minor degree, but meaningfully different than sort of a standard 60-40 traditional portfolio.
Interesting. So I think it would be fun to dig into what does meaningfully different. So let's first start off for the listeners out there that may not know that much about investing. And you mentioned about 60-40. Let's say that's kind of typical way people maybe benchmark or think about, maybe I'll have 60% in stocks and 40% in bonds. Yeah. Now, in my book, How to Start Building Your Wealth Investing in the Stock Market, I always say 110 minus your age is maybe a good guide. In fact, I would probably at this point in my life say 120, simply because when you're 20 years old, you probably should have 100% in stocks, in the sense that you need that compounding happening. And you know, what's the point of having bonds at the age of 20 when you've got, you know, 40-year time horizon? But the idea of 60-40 is that, okay, once you get up to an older age, then you want to have less of the volatility and all of that. So for many people, they see two asset classes, stocks and bonds. Now, in fact, you could argue, are they really separate asset classes in the sense that they're both coming from a company? Now, you could say, okay, government bonds, you could argue, is a truly different asset class, or let's say the cash flow is generated from a truly different entity. I'm just curious, so how do we think, if we don't think necessarily 60-40, what do we think?
Great context you put, and I totally agree with you on the risk scale. Age obviously tremendously matters of how much in terms of risk exposure you should have. But really at its core, it's really thinking through diversification, and we use the word true diversification to describe how we think about portfolio construction. So starting with stocks, and let's say a standard portfolio might have 60 or 70% in stocks. That's all well and good. The challenge is, as we know, diversification works in flat to up markets, but what happens in down markets, especially really nasty down markets, without getting too technical, but correlations go to one, right? It really doesn't even matter what sector you're in. If you hit a nasty economic environment and or bear market, all stocks will go down together. So that's sort of the 60% part of the portfolio. Now, what about bonds?
And just go ahead. Highlight. Mm-hmm. So it's an important concept of this correlation. And the reason why we're investing in different assets and different asset classes is because we're trying to take advantage of the idea that there is a minimal correlation between various ones. And when you say basically in times of trouble, correlations go to one, in the sense that, number one, you mentioned stocks. So let's just say you had two different groups of stocks that really have a low correlation, but all of a sudden when everything falls, they all fall together. And then the correlation is also in relation to things like, let's say, bonds or maybe gold, like, you know, as an example, where you can see all asset class correlations go to one. Which, are you talking about both of those, or explain what you mean by that?
Yeah. So starting with the stocks, that's a simple one, right? But then moving on to other asset classes, I guess the way we think about it is what drives movements up in asset prices or down in asset prices with most traditional assets. And it's really two main things. It's the economy. Obviously, a strong economy is healthy for both stocks. And you mentioned bonds, most especially corporate bonds do well in a good economy. In a recession or tough economy, the opposite happens. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is interest rates.
Yeah.
Interest rates, just the most important thing that drive prices. We've been in such an incredible, we're all so spoiled, right? Going back 40 years in really a declining interest rate environment, declining interest rates propelled all asset prices up, both stocks and bonds. So when we're looking for other pieces of the pie to mix in with our stock and bond portfolio, it is really looking at things that will behave somewhat unrelated to those two risk factors, both the economy, what things can do okay, can do well, no matter what direction the economy takes. Same with interest rates. What are things that can do okay, potentially even thrive if interest rates rise? So that's where we're looking at truly things that will behave differently. One last point I'll make, just going to the bond piece. You hit on it on the intro part of this discussion. A lot of bonds are actually more correlated stocks because you're either taking equity in a company or lending to a company. So in both of those instances, you're correlated because you want that company to do well. But then there are other safer bonds you mentioned, like government bonds. Listen, government bonds, were wonderful again over the last 40 years in a declining interest rate environment. But once interest rates hit zero, I mean, it made no sense to touch bonds that had zero yield. Now, at least rates have moved up a little bit and you could get reasonably paid for buying something like a government bond. But the concern is, even with government bonds, are we in a new paradigm? And I mean, you know, maybe the 1970s would be the best example where inflation changes everything. Inflation is a game changer. Where can we be in more of a quasi, somewhat stagflationary type environment? Maybe not the end of the world, but maybe sort of a slow growth environment, but coupled with inflation, where you not only have stocks that are challenged, but now bonds are challenged as well. So bonds that used to be that stalwart ballast of the portfolio that would move counter to stocks, maybe will go down at the same time. We had a little glimpse of that in 2022. Both stocks and bonds got really hit hard. Bonds did not do what they were supposed to do. Our concern is, no guarantee, but will the next decade look more like that than not?
So there's two things I want to unpack. And the first one, you talked about economy and interest rates.
Yeah.
Technically, let's look at the long-term government bond. Let's say 10-year government bond. The composition of the interest rate is, in theory, a combination of economy and inflation.
Yeah.
When you're talking about economy and interest rates, are you really talking about economy and inflation, or are you talking about economy and interest rates?
They're obviously related. Now that you phrase it that way, yes, it's more economy and inflation. And so we've been so spoiled to be in a mild inflationary environment for most of our careers, lifetimes. We've never been faced, our industry at large, with a more volatile and or rising inflationary environment where, on a real terms, one, if interest rates rise, disastrous for bonds. But even if interest rates don't go up, let's say they stay flat, are you still making enough on an inflation-adjusted basis? Because government bonds yielding 3-4%, listen, CPI data, we all know inflation is really higher than what is reported by the government. Not drastically so, but if you're going to make 3-4% over the long run, are you really keeping up with inflation? We have a lot of doubts.
And when we talk about, you know, you talked about the 40-year decline in interest rates. You know, if we go back to, let's say I graduated from high school in 1983, and, you know, right then Volcker had been squeezing, trying to bring interest rates down from 20% or so at the time. And, you know, there was some amazing headwinds that we are never going to get again. And the first one was declining oil price.
Yeah.
So we had 20 years of declining oil price, number one. The second one was we had about 700 million people enter the job market between China, Bangladesh, Vietnam, and different countries that all of a sudden, when I left Ohio, where I originally grew up, I left Ohio in about 1986. You know, there's a vibrant industrial base.
Yeah.
That's gone. That's all shipped over to Asia, let's say, in general, and China specifically. And what we saw was that it was just impossible to be able to compete with this 700 million people, low wage earners at the time, entering the workforce. So between the combination of falling oil prices and the entrance of this huge influx of low-cost labor, we naturally had a falling interest rate and a falling inflation environment. Now, you could say, well, Andrew, AI is the next thing that's going to bring us that deflationary, you know, a reduction in inflation. But I'm curious, you know, where your thoughts are, because I did hear you on another thing on your LinkedIn. You have a lot of little clips, and I watched some of those, and you know, you talked about this idea of, you know, we had a once in a lifetime period of very low interest rates, but could we be wrong? Could it be that AI is going to bring us, you know, the same type of thing that falling oil prices and 700 million new people into the workforce did for deflation?
Listen, without a doubt, AI is powerful, and I'm a believer in the technology, and productivity can, hopefully, knock on wood, grow as a result of AI. So listen, I'm a believer. That being said, we strongly believe that there are more powerful forces at work. A lot of it is around debt levels. the massive one, comparing and contrasting us versus, let's say, the early 80s, where Volcker had a lot of guts to do what he did. That being said, we had such low levels of debt, he was able to do that. So he was able to crush those inflationary pressures. So beyond the dynamics that you talked about, Volcker was a big force in decreasing inflation too, because he was able to jack interest rates up. It's not possible. We cannot do, if inflation, if we get into wage price spirals, if it rears its ugly head, tariff issues we're facing right now. I mean, news just today about supply shipping collapsing out of China, just like literally today. I mean, there could be some real supply crunches here. If inflation picks back up, the challenge is the Fed doesn't have room to massively raise interest rates. Why? Because our debt levels are just, on a debt to GDP basis, astronomically higher than what Volcker was facing.
Yeah.
So listen, there's a lot of moving parts, pros and cons. AI is a great example of it. That being said, when we think about fundamentals and the biggest concern from a generational point of view that will drive inflation and growth, et cetera, it's debt. It is debt, government debt. We think it's utterly out of control and unsustainable.
One of the ironies of America is, I've always been kind of amazed at how Americans are so comfortable with price controls on the cost of money.
Yeah.
But they would never, be comfortable with price controls on, iPhones as an example or anything like that. And it's just, they've been so acclimated to it that it's just like everything hinges on that. Let me ask you another question before we get to the big question of the podcast. But the other question is, how many asset classes are there, for instance? The reason why I ask that is because I read some research and they talk about small cap value and they call those asset classes, but I've always considered any stock as part of the equity asset class. And then bonds, both government and corporate, part of the bond asset class. And then I can come up with commodities.
Yep.
And you could say gold, but truthfully, gold is a commodity.
Sure.
So stocks, bonds, commodities. Now, someone says, oh, yeah, but there's private credit. Well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
That's lending.
Yeah, it's bonds.
Yeah. So just out of curiosity, you're allocating all the time. What does it mean when people say these are different asset classes? What are the different asset classes?
I love that question. I'm going to talk about it both sides of my mouth. So as a starting point, I agree with you, actually. Even though we talk about lots of asset classes, at its core, there's equity and debt. Ownership, which is higher risk, theoretically some leverage to enhance that, those returns, or bonds. You lend on different opportunities and you're more in a more secure position. Now, that being said, the limitation that most face with a 60-40 bond stock bond portfolio is the public markets are only a small slice of the total investable pie in terms of both equity and debt. And it's only through, we found, and maybe there's little glimmers within the public markets, but generally it's only within the private markets that we can find equity and most specifically debt, debt structures, you mentioned private credit, that will just be very, very different than public bonds. Different in a number of ways, covenants much stronger, much better in the way of controls. And most importantly, and we could talk more about our approach to lending, this is where the non-correlation comes in. The way the lion's share of corporate bond investors make loans, it's all based on underlying cash flow or earnings of the underlying company. That's all well and good. And we do some of that too. But when I talk about true low or non-correlation, it's being agnostic to the company you're lending on and focusing on the underlying collateral, the assets that you can attach to. So if you're lending to a company, great. You hope the company does well, but that's secondary. The key is, what are you lending on? Are you lending on their inventory, their trucking fleet, their real estate, their cash? And if that's what you're lending on, and this is where our primary focus is on across a variety of industries, focusing on assets as protection, that even if things don't go according to plan, And that's something we strongly believe in. We're very humble in the way of we have no crystal ball. We embrace uncertainty as opposed to trying to have predictions of what's going to happen to the underlying economy or the company we're lending to. So even if things don't go according to plan, knock on wood, we're going to be okay because we have those assets to lean on.
So let's imagine that all of these private loans are tradable in the stock market. And you could compare the existing. And so just for the listener and viewer out there that may not completely get that, if we think about corporate bonds that are traded in the stock market, they are, as you said, based upon the cash flow of the entity generally.
Yep. Yep.
And basically, that's the benefit of being a large listed company is because your data is public and people are scrutinizing it, the banks can lend the entity can issue bonds based on cash flow.
Yep.
So now we have this whole set of bonds that are listed in the market that are pretty much all cash flow based.
Yep.
Now let's imagine that there's also a set of bonds that are cash flow and asset based. Let's say maybe not 100% asset based, but let's just say that the collateral plays a role in that. And so now all of those bonds, or let's say all that lending is in the form of bonds that have asset backing.
Mm-hmm.
What we're really talking about now is, in theory, what we're talking about is lower risk lending to possibly to second tier, not in credit quality, but in, let's say, what is it? You know, because they're listed, let's say, because of the corporate bonds right now are mainly, it's transparency, let's say, but these are, there's more work involved and all that.
Yep.
But now we've got this whole group of bonds that are backed by asset as well as cash flow.
Yep.
Would those trade at an interest rate above or below the corporate bonds in general that are based only on cash flow?
Well, I love that you say that because intuitively, right, they should trade at a lower yield because they're safer. Without a doubt, they trade at a higher yield and meaningfully so. Meaningfully so. And there's some reasons for it. One is a lot of these companies they're not publicly traded, right? So then the thought is, oh, there's more risk in private companies. But again, many of these loans we're making are not $1 to $5 million loans. They're $10 to $50 or even $100 million loans. So these are substantial companies. The other aspect is, I don't want to be completely misleading in that a lot of these companies are not, listen, if they were growing like gangbusters, they could go to traditional lenders and get cheaper debt. A lot of them are companies in transition, maybe going sideways. So there is some maybe hair on these companies. But still, one of the reasons that there's an supply-demand imbalance in terms of the amount of lenders that are willing to make these loans is it's a lot more work. If you think about a cash flow loan, like let's say Morton Wealth, our company, we make nice, consistent cash flow. We grow from one year to year. We're even a small company. We're not publicly traded. But if we needed to get a loan, we could go to a local organization and get a loan really quickly. Mm. They would just look at our last few years of financial statements, bring it to their board and make a decision in a couple weeks. Very different than, let's say, another company our size, but maybe didn't have consistent cash flow like we do, but had a huge trucking fleet. How do you value that trucking fleet? It takes a lot of work. You got to go verify those trucks. You got to go really understand the market. If you had to sell those trucks, what type of liquidity, appraisers getting involved. It's a messier business. That works to our advantage because the lenders, there's only specialty lenders that are willing to do that hard work. The end result is they can charge a higher interest rate.
Okay, so let's
look
at that.
Loans. Yeah.
So let's imagine that all the corporate bonds out there,
mm-hmm.
that we could split them in half and half of them were asset backed as well as cash flow backed. In theory, those bonds would trade at a lower return. But what you're saying is that, well, because of the size and the challenge and the additional work involved and all of that,
yep.
and the lack of transparency, so there's a lot more work involved to hold them accountable and all that, that what you're saying is that the reduction in interest rate caused by having asset backing the loan is you won't experience that lower return because all of the additional risks, credit risk, as well as extra cost involved in doing it will bring that return to be a higher return than what we would see from the bonds out in the market. So I think
even like a simple analogy, I mean, like even like think about stock investing, passive versus active management, right? Passive investing is going to be cheaper, lower cost funds. It makes sense. Why? It's no work. It's easy, right?
Yep.
Name the firm, BlackRock can make a fund and then tomorrow it could be tens of billions of dollars in assets versus active management, really hard, right? You got to hire analysts, a team, et cetera. You know, there's an extra cost associated with that. Similar on the asset-based side, it's just, yeah, it's not so easy.
Except the difference
is that works to our benefit.
On the asset-backed side, you're much more likely to get the upside, additional upside, the compensation, whereas on the active side is harder just because of the competition in the market. So I like this conversation because a lot of times when people talk about private credit,
yeah,
in the end, what they're really just talking about is they're not getting daily price quotes
on their 100%. Portfolio.
And they're like, that's low risk. You know, So if a tree falls in the woods and no one hears it, did it actually fall? Well, of course it fell. There's plenty of risk in that. It's just that it's not being priced on a daily basis. And so is that really risk reduction? I wouldn't say it is. It is price volatility reduction, but that's not really risk to me.
Couldn't agree more. The private industry takes advantage of the lack of pricing. We all know that, right? And inflates risk-adjusted returns, Sharpe ratios, that's all fake. I couldn't care less about that. That's not what I care about. What I care about is true downside. Really thinking through scenarios, downside, stress testing, what can break this loan? What can happen that, whether to the company or something out of the company's control? We're facing it right now, right? With tariff-related issues, geopolitical events, you name it. Really thinking through downside. Again, you talk, I know, about so much about managing risk. It's the theme of your podcast and so much you write about. That's our obsession. What is a nasty environment? And in a nasty environment, are we going to get our money back? As opposed to a cash flow loan, all well and good until if there are no backing of assets, you know what happens. Knock on wood, maybe you could get back 80 cents on the dollar, 70 cents on the dollar. But you know what? That might even go to zero if the cash flow goes away. No interest in lending in more extreme situations.
Okay, so this is a great discussion. And what it comes down to is so far we've identified two asset classes, stocks and bonds, and within, or stocks and lending, let's call it, whether that's through bonds or whether that's through loans. And we've now clearly delineated number one, government bonds, number two, high quality cash flow backed corporate bonds, and number three, private credit, which is generally asset-backed and tends to have a higher return.
Yeah.
So it's a subdivision within the lending area.
Yeah.
Now, that one of the things that I, in my book that I wrote about investing for beginners, I told people, don't bother investing your portfolio in real estate. And I said, for two reasons. Number one, most of what you would be offered in the stock market is really a real estate investment trust.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a broad-based exposure to the stock market, let's just say through a passive fund as an example, you already have those real estate investment trusts in the index.
Yep.
Because it's listed in the market.
Yep.
So you're doubling your exposure to them. However, the second type of investment in real estate, I would argue, is a separate asset class, and that is your home and the land that your home is on.
Yeah.
And that I would say that land, as opposed to the rental business, that is generally what a REIT is, land is a separate asset class.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me I'm right or wrong.
I agree with you. I agree with you. There's a lot more real estate within stocks than people realize when you peek under the hood. Land behaves differently, really is its own animal as compared to cash flowing real estate. But a couple of points to emphasize. We've definitely done REIT investing in the past. The challenge with REITs, though, is it goes back to the correlation. Not completely, but there are times where it will move more like stocks as opposed to private real estate. And so all that means is sometimes there's opportunities in REITs versus private real estate. But let me go back to maybe one more example now, which has been a core position of ours going back to 2009 or 10, going back to the lending side. So you're mainly talking now about equities, ownership of real estate. What about lending on real estate? There's a whole asset class of lending on real estate, again, tends to be smaller and niche, so a more inefficient part of the market just because it's smaller. The big boys aren't playing there, but smaller is good because there's less competition and you could charge higher rates. Where typically you can make loans on, are you familiar with like the bridge lending space, like short-term loans?
Yeah, definitely. But I think my audience may not necessarily know all of that. So maybe just explain that briefly. We've had some people on that have been in that business. So yes.
I'll give a brief overview. It's been really a wonderful and resilient and consistent asset class for us going back, you know, call it 15 years or so. Where a typical story is, it might be, let's say, a real estate developer who's looking to buy an apartment building. Let's say it's a $10 million building, you know, small fourplex, eightplex, whatever it is. And they're looking to close quickly on that. So they go to their bank and they try to get a loan. And the bank says, sure, but it'll take 3 months. And the guy says, I don't have 3 months. I want to close on this quickly. So they go to what's called a bridge lender who can close on that loan very quickly in a week or two. And the bridge lender, the groups that we invest with, they just make a short-term loan. So typically the most common term is 12 months. So that's great as a starting point because we talk about interest rate risk. The biggest risk with interest rates is duration on bonds. These are very short-term bonds. That's as a starting point.
And the bridge lender has access to the collateral if they can't get the full lending, or how does that?
You should think of the bridge lender as the bank. They own the keys, just like the lender does on your home. They are in first position.
Yep.
There is no one ahead of that lender. So that's key, right? You own the collateral. Again, this goes down to the example I gave with corporations of the trucking fleet or inventory. If something goes wrong with the real estate or that real estate professional, they can't pay on the loan, you own the keys to that real estate. Now, the last key component is, all right, how big of a loan on a loan to value? And the standard in terms of the funds, the world that we lend on, is basically 60% loan to value. So what that means is on that $10 million property, they're not lending, let's say 80%, maybe like a bank would lend. They're lending 60% or $6 million. So even in a challenging real estate environment, and by the way, we're in one right now. Mm-hmm. Real estate has been challenged in the U.S. with rising interest rates. But you have a 40% cushion in terms of declining interest rate values. And by the way, that happens has to happen within a quick 12-month period for your principal to be threatened. And so it's a place where you're a short duration loan, relatively high interest rate, and backed by collateral. You could be diversified geographically. We are across the country, literally in the funds across thousands of loans. So it's been a really consistent, resilient asset class for us. Where, for example, just it kind of marches to the beat of its own drummer. When things are going well, this does well. But then 2022, great example, when bonds got crushed, you wouldn't even, if you looked at the return stream of these things, you wouldn't even noticed. It would have looked like it was marching to the beat of its own drummer. It made just like what it made the year before, or the year after, because there's no real interest rate sensitivity because the nature of the loans are so short term.
And if the value of the property went down by 40%, you'd still get your money back.
Listen, and you would still get your money back. Listen, that's where theoretically it gets a little messy. You might have to foreclose on the property. You might then have to go sell it. There's costs. So listen,
you don't want to be in that situation.
You don't want to be in that situation. But that is, listen, we've been lucky. Don't get me wrong. We've had tremendous tailwinds over the last 15 years. Real estate's pretty much gone up outside the last couple of years. So we've had very few circumstances where that's happened. In recent years, that's picked up a little bit where, you know, maybe there's been a foreclosure and you'd have to work something out. But yes, generally speaking, even in really, really bad scenarios, you're principally protected because, you know, that 40% cushion is very big.
So now we've kind of built some subdivision within real estate investing. We talked about REITs. We talked about, you know, your own, let's say your own landed house, which for many people who aren't rich, that could be a huge allocation of their overall wealth. And therefore, they have good exposure to that. And then lending on commercial real estate, the bridge lender type of thing, is a subdivision within the real estate asset class. Mm-hmm. So we kind of said, okay, there's stocks, there's equity, there's lending, and there's real estate. Certain parts of real estate really behave as a separate asset class. Is commodities an asset class to you?
Yeah, I would say commodities is. Commodities is the one other one that I'd say behaves differently. We dabble in certain commodities. That being said, where we've had a meaningful core position, which I quasi call a commodity, and you alluded to this, is gold. Mm. We've been investing in gold really since 2015 for quite some time. And while gold has some features of a commodity, one of the reasons we tend to not have overweights in other commodities, it goes down to the correlation argument. Most commodities are dependent on the economy. Think about copper. You think about other commodities, oil, et cetera. In growing economies, those will do well. In recessions, what happens to commodities? They get crushed. So actually, there's a decent amount of correlation ultimately from a long-term point of view to stocks. Both depend on a growing economy. Gold, and that's a whole separate discussion that we could potentially dive into, but gold truly marches to the beat of its own drummer, where there's plenty of instances, and listen, we're in it right now, where gold really diverges from other commodities. And that's because we really believe there's a different use case, different rationale on why someone should own gold.
Would you say commodities is an asset class and gold is an asset class?
I view gold to some degree as a cash alternative.
Okay.
It's an alternative currency from my point of view. The lion's share of investors, their net worth is in the dollar. Yep. The dollar is by its very nature something that's going to debase over time.
Yep.
And gold we view as the other currency that will theoretically keep its value. It's volatile, don't get me wrong, but over the long term, will keep its value, purchasing power as a store of value, especially against a dollar where we have a printing press and we all know what happens with the value of the dollar over time.
So we've talked about asset classes, let's say stocks, or let's say investing companies. We talked about, we can use the word bonds, but let's say that's lending to government or lending to companies in various ways. And then we talked about commodities as a separate asset class, although at times it's really driven by the economy. So its correlation is questionable. And then we've talked about gold, and you've kind of classified it, as you said, as a cash alternative that has a unique correlation or movements relative to the economic situation.
Yeah.
Is there any other asset class?
My knee-jerk reaction is no. I guess I would expand on then how we can create, going back to the true diversification argument, when you think about various examples, and I actually just listened to the podcast you just released with Larry Swedrow, where he talked about things like reinsurance. These are various forms of lending.
Mm.
Healthcare royalties. We do a lot of healthcare royalty investing, where in essence, all you're doing is you're lending to a biotech company, and in exchange for that working capital, you buy a share of a royalty stream of some sort of pharmaceutical drug or medical device. That's just lending too. But again, when we think about risk factors, that's when I think about asset classes, really what I'm saying is, what are the risk factors that will drive the performance of that underlying investment? And so that's an example of a healthcare royalty, a drug that's fighting some, let's say an immunology drug that's fighting cancer. That's a loan, totally different, completely different than the loan I made to a company that's where the collateral is its trucking fleet. I mean, that's like it's apples and oranges. So I know I'm making it somewhat simplistic, but those are almost two completely different asset classes.
So for the people that are listening or viewing that don't fully get what you just said, you could take a portfolio that someone has, let's say of 100 stocks.
Yeah.
And you could say, okay, they have exposure to various sectors, healthcare, you know, utilities, whatever. And we could say that those sectors have different exposures. But then what you could also just do is say, what are the risk factors that this portfolio overall is influenced by? And let's say one is inflation, and let's say another one is GDP growth. Let's say, you know, another one is currency, maybe, or the like. And we can list out a series of risk factors, and then we can go back to our portfolio and maybe back test it and say, what level of exposure do we have to these very risk factors? And you find out, oh, wait a minute, even though we're diversified across these different asset classes, we're actually really, really overweight or heavily invested in a particular risk factor. Let's say inflation as an example. Yep. And then you may say, I don't care about, you know, asset classes. I need assets that will reduce my exposure to any particular risk factor. Is that what you're saying?
I love how you said that. It really comes down to risk factors. It's really thinking through, that's where we spend our time, really poking holes in the various opportunities we're looking at and thinking through the broader macro risk factors that can break that investment. Mm-hmm. And to your point, the challenge with so many traditional investments, and of course we have traditional investments too, but the reason we have so many other pieces of the pie is when you look at those risk factors, the ones we all care about, recession or not, what's going to happen with geopolitical risk, war, et cetera, inflation, more often than not, those traditional assets have overexposure to those things as opposed to less exposure to those things.
Yeah. Okay. Last thing, just because mm-hmm. of the job that you do and the service that you provide, yeah. you talk about long-term. And I think a lot of people, you know, understand the importance of setting long-term goals, diversifying and all that. So yeah. if you're a long-term investor and you wake up one day and you see on the news, it says, all asset classes have a correlation of one today, right? Okay. Does it matter? I mean, come on. For 30 years, let's say, prior to today, they didn't have a correlation of one. Mm-hmm. And within 1 week, 1 month, 1 year, they won't have a correlation of one yep. again. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I never really got this point mm-hmm. of correlation of one, because if you say all asset classes have a correlation of one, yeah. oh my God, now we're all correlated at one. I got to do something.
Yeah.
No, actually, it's just a moment in time
yep.
where actually one of the best things to do in this type of moment in time is nothing. So I'm just curious, like, how are we supposed to think about when people say there's a correlation of one?
Listen, I agree with you, and like, just to give advice to more of the traditional investor who is even more in a 60-40 portfolio, you should not be panicking and selling at the wrong time. And when correlations do go to one, you got to take your hit and then ride through it, because things will come back. I'm not saying things will go down forever. That being said, all moments in time should not be weighted equally. Again, it comes down to managing risk, which I know you have your like six tenets. And for us, that's one of our core tenets. It's risk management. And risk management really only matters in those rare times. And I acknowledge this is only 5 or 10% of the time, but that's where wealth is really destroyed. Mm-hmm. And bear markets can be nasty. And they happen more often than people realize. Again, we've been spoiled and snapback has happened so quickly. Like the COVID, it went down 36%. It came back, you know, within months, not even years. Really, it's been since 08 we had a nasty time. And then money printing came and saved the day. That's even a second question. Can money printing save the day the next time? So our concern is that it's about permanent loss of capital. And when I mean permanent, yes, I mean more long-term than a moment in time. The 70s were, we've had periods of time, right? The 70s were an example. The 30s were an example. Actually, let me make one more point. Because definitely, we view stocks, because we, of course, have stocks. We just have less exposure to stocks than most. Yep. But we, to your point, stocks have to be viewed as a long-term investment, without a doubt. We would say longer term than what most people think. More than 10 years, even 15 or 20 years.
Yep.
Because if you look back at, let's say, the last 100 years, I think you could really break it down into three 30-year segments. And in each of those 30-year segments, what you have is about 10 of those 30 years where stocks are flat, losing to inflation, really bad returns. That's from 1929 to 1943, flat. And then the next 20-ish years, returns were wonderful. Then 1966 to 1974, flat. Actually took until 1982 to break even with inflation. Talk about long term. That's a bad, long time to be investing in stocks and wait. Then the lost decade of the 2000s. This every people should expect. 10 out of every 30 years, you're going to have a long, long wait. Now, that doesn't mean you don't own stocks. It just means I strongly believe that should represent then an appropriate part of your portfolio. With that description of volatility, I don't think that should represent 60 or 70% of a portfolio. And by the way, valuations matter. If stocks were trading in the high single digit or low double digit PE ratio, I would be singing a different tune. But that is not the case. By almost any objective measure, I mean, we're trading maybe not quite at 1999 levels, but near all-time highs in terms of PE ratios, et cetera. That's not a place where you should be backing up the truck and investing a lot in stocks. One last point. This isn't just me saying this. I mean, you look at all market predictors. It came out a lot last year. I think it was Goldman Sachs predicted the next 10 years of stock returns, 3%, less than inflation. Morgan Stanley, their CIO, came out and basically he said stocks are going to be about flattish for the next 10 years. It all comes down to valuation. Again, that doesn't mean you have no stocks, but that's not something I would really lean into and say, okay, that should be 50, 60, 70% of my portfolio.
So is what you're saying is that the 60, let's just imagine that the typical 60-40 is suitable for someone at that stage of their life, but what you're telling them is that, well, wait a minute, there's times that 60 should be 80 and there's times that 60 should be 40.
Yes. My range would still be a little lower than that because I think maybe 60 on the upside and much less on the downside. Our typical client right now, because driven by valuations, might have 20 or 25% in stocks. But that's also because we feel like you can have your cake and eat it too in these other areas of the market. And again, they're private. The trade-off is some illiquidity. You can make stock-like returns, knock on wood, at much, much reduced risk. Again, where you're the lender as opposed to the equity owner. So why not? Why not do that?
Okay. Now, I got one last thing. I promise. Okay. This is it.
I've enjoyed this.
Yeah. Okay. So for the most people that would be listening, they're like, okay, great, Jeff and Andrew. Thanks for your fun conversation. But how the hell do I invest in all of this private credit and all that? And this is where I talk a lot with Larry Swedrow about, you know, what are the instruments and how can we do it? Yeah. Or is that can really only be done by a large, you know, or let's say mid to large size asset management company or asset wealth management company that can get access to it? You know, are there ETFs? Are there funds? Or what does an individual investor do?
So listen, there's no shortcut. You talk about doing your research, like point number one on your list. We actually have a saying, investing starts with investing in yourself. Like you got to do the work. Now, I know this will sound self-serving, but you should maybe partner up with a financial advisor who has this expertise. But if not, you know, there's research out there and you could do the work. The nice thing is there has been really a proliferation in the last decade of more instruments that you can have access to some of these private markets in more user-friendly formats. All I can say, and there are plenty of them are wonderful, don't get me wrong, but you got to be very, very careful. Because the challenge with a lot of these, there's a few challenges, but the main one is a lot of them promise liquidity that really is not appropriate for the underlying illiquidity of the asset class you're investing in. Yep. So there's a lot of quarterly and illiquid investments out there, and many of them are wonderful, and we invest in some of them. But if you're investing in a quarterly liquid instrument where you're buying real estate, that really should be a 10-year hold. And how do you price real estate? How do people get in and out of something with that type of opaque pricing? That's a recipe for real issues. We even saw a glimpse of that with the Blackstone REIT, where there was a run on the bank, if you will, with regards to that. Especially in a tough environment, we could see real runs on these funds and illiquidity that could be really problematic. So there's a lot of nuance with this stuff. That being said, there's a lot more availability now than there used to be.
And Larry, in the back of his book, talks about he gives some ETFs or some instruments, let's say, that people could consider when constructing their portfolios. And under reinsurance, he talks about Pioneer and Stone Ridge.
Oh, sure.
Alternative lending, he talks about Cliffwater. And one of the things about these, though, is that they're almost all funds.
Yes.
And funds are, you know, probably more suited for this because you can kind of lock in a little bit more as opposed to an ETF that's really based upon the inflows and outflows to a large extent. But are there any ETFs that a person, let's say, sitting in Thailand that could invest in private credit or something like that? You know,
my short answer is I don't know, because I think there's been some, but this should not be in a daily liquid product.
Yeah.
So the nature of those firms you mentioned, I'm fans of all of them, is they tend to have appropriate illiquidity. They tend to be quarterly liquid instruments.
Yep.
And again, I'm not sure, depending on the jurisdiction, if the average retail investor can access those or if you have to go through a wealth manager. That I'm not sure. Larry would probably know better than me. But there are new ETFs that are popping up that I've seen. My intuition with some of these, again, is I would stay away. because, again, you're investing in illiquid assets in daily liquid structures, and there's just an inappropriate mismatch.
Oh, that really helps explain it. So I appreciate that. Wow. What a discussion with a lot of things that we covered. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate the time on that. Normally, I don't spend that much time, but I figured we had a good opportunity to do that. So I appreciate that.
No, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. So now it's time to share your worst investment ever. And since no one goes into their worst investment thinking it will be, tell us a bit about the circumstances leading up to it and then tell us your story.
Okay. It was early in my career, probably like a lot of your guests that I've heard, you know, a lot of the mistakes we make as young entrants into the industry. I entered the industry in the late 90s in the dot-com boom. And so it was 1999 where it wasn't a lot of money in the grand scheme of things. I was just starting to make a little bit of money. But what did I do? I bought the dot-com companies. And I thought I was being safe because I bought the name brands, right? The Yahoos and EMCs and Sun Microsystems. I stayed away from the pets.com. So I thought I was being smart and safe. But then we all know what happened, right? All of these dropped 90%+ and then some. And that was just a tremendous, tremendous learning experience on so many facets. One is, again, something I know you talk about, you harp on so much, failing to do your research. I should have known better. I was actually just getting my CFA. I was an analyst. I knew these stocks didn't make sense, but I still lean into them. And why? It's emotions, right? I embrace my emotions instead of pushing back against them. So it was fear, and it was greed, it was FOMO, and it was also to some degree even a lack of imagination where I was like, oh, sure, these can get hit, but maybe they'll be down 20 or 30 or 40%. I had no concept that these things can be down 90, 95%. And I think I have concerns around the current environment where, I mean, we've even seen it since then, right? Great companies, by the way, companies like Zoom and Peloton, you name it, have dropped whatever it is, 80%+, 90%. Mm-hmm. When stocks get untethered from fundamentals, and even some of these, the Magnificent Seven stocks, in many ways, some of them have, people are like, it would be so bad if they dropped 20 or 30%. I think that's a lack of imagination. Of course they can drop more than that. That doesn't mean they're not amazing companies. They are amazing companies. But like Cisco's a great example, was the largest company in the world in 1999. I just looked it up the other day. So it dropped like 90%. Its revenue now is triple what it was in 1999. I didn't realize that. The company is three times the size. But where is it? It's a $200 billion market cap now. It's one-fourth the size in terms of its stock price. 25 years later, even though it's triple the size. So now it goes back to long-term, right? Talk about long-term. You wait 25 years, it ain't coming back. So that was a big learning lesson and obviously shaped a lot of how I think about diversification and correlation and being in things outside of traditional stocks.
It's interesting because for the younger listeners, they didn't know a guy named John Chambers who was running Cisco.
Yeah,
and really,
right?
You know, he was pumping the story, but he was delivering, you know, and it was the internet boom and he was into the hardware aspect of it. And so there was a lot to get excited about.
There was. He was running an incredible company, but again, yeah. At a certain point, price matters.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how amazing that company was. Got dislodged from fundamentals.
Yeah. And I think what I took away from that is something that you said when the prices get untethered from the earnings.
Yeah.
And I think what you actually meant to say was when they get untethered from earnings growth in the sense that our expectation of the future is what matters. You know, it's great that, you know, Microsoft, as an example,
yeah,
Amazon, NVIDIA, they have grown their earnings massively. And so the PE in relation to current earnings, you know, you can say it's not like the dot-com bubble in the sense that there are underlying earnings, but it really is about the earnings expectation, earnings growth expectations, where the untethering really is possibly happening. And those companies will not be able to deliver the growth in the earnings. They may be able to deliver the same level, let's just say, same level of earnings.
Yep.
But without the growth, people will say, well, I'm going to go somewhere else and get that earnings growth because that is a major driver of the share price, that I don't even need this company to expand its multiple. If it can deliver 20% earnings growth, my share price is going to go up by 20%. Did you mean prospective earnings growth
Without a doubt. People are, I think, rearview mirror looking and imagine what happened in the last 5 years will happen in the next five. And again, it goes back to Cisco. Great example. Cisco actually delivered. Of course, they had a tough time in 01 and 02 and their business contracted, but they came roaring back. So they even grew their earnings and still it's trading at a fraction of what it did 25 years ago.
Jeff, if you ever decide to write a book on the history of the markets, I think you should write one on Cisco, because what a great story, you know, of the rise and then surviving. And then as you've just taught us, you know, about the idea of even though they've survived and actually done well, that doesn't mean your share price does well. Okay, so based on what you learned from this story and what you continue to learn, let's imagine a young person that gets excited the way you and I did when we first started investing. What's one action you'd recommend our listeners take to avoid suffering the same fate?
Oh, man, that's a great question. I'm hesitant to recommend anything because the truth is the way I learned is I made the mistake. I mean, I did it and I had money at risk.
You give the Nike recommendation.
Right. Just do it. There is an element though, like people and analysts, young people in my company who are like playing in stocks and I have an options background. So they ask me and they like making trades and the and I give them advice, but at a certain point, I don't want to give too much advice because the only way you can really learn is by doing it and making mistakes. That being said, it goes back to something we hit on before. It's doing the research. You got to do the research. I went afoul of the research that I knew and the fundamentals and all the stuff I learned in my CFA and Graham and Dodd and all of the fundamentals of investing. And I just ignored it. Mm. And so don't take shortcuts. Or if you do, at least understand what you're doing. You're gambling. You're speculating. That's different than investment.
Yeah.
And okay, that's okay. As long as you know, honestly, if you're being honest with yourself, what you're doing, you're speculating and not investing. And there's a time and place for that. And there's a dollar allocation for that. So keep that speculative piece of your portfolio small.
Good advice. If you're going to go to Las Vegas, just do it 1 week out of 52, not 52 weeks. Weekends.
I love that.
Okay. So what's a resource either of yours or any other you'd recommend for our listeners?
Yeah, listen, there's a couple things. One is we really are passionate about financial education. So we put out a lot of content. So our website, mortonwealth.com, we have a weekly podcast. I write quarterly newsletters, lots of stuff. But then beyond that, lots of listening to podcasts. I'm excited I connected with you in recent weeks. I've really listened to some of your stuff. Really enjoyed it. I think there's a lot of synergies. Again, you talk about the six investment mistakes that are so consistent with some of ours. The last thing I'll think about, I guess, a couple of books that really made a real difference for me. Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman.
Yep.
Just really talking about, it's really humbling how much our emotions, again, drive investment decisions. So being able to really compartmentalize and really understand those emotions and know those pitfalls. Huge fan of that book. And then I know you've had like Morgan Housel on, I believe, a long time ago. Some of his work is great as well.
Yeah. Fantastic. Great resources. And last question, what is your number one goal for the next 12 months?
That's a good question. Honestly, what I'm super excited about is continuing to find some of these uncorrelated opportunities. It's all we do. We've been doing it for a long time, but we're continuing to find more opportunities. And I think interesting thing happened a couple of years ago with regional banks, like with that whole fiasco. Mm-hmm. Traditional lenders have really left and they really only focus on cash flow lending. So more interesting, safer stuff is falling in our laps and otherwise we wouldn't have seen before, again, in non-correlated areas. So long story short, my investment team and I, we've been traveling the country, uncovering some new niche opportunities, and I'm excited for more that we're going to find. Mm,
great. Well, listeners, there you have it, another story of loss to keep you winning. Remember, I'm on a mission to help 1 million people reduce risk in their lives. As we conclude, Jeff, I want to thank you again for joining our mission. And on behalf of Ace Dots Academy, I hereby award you alumni status for turning your worst investment ever into your best teaching moment. Do you have any parting words for the audience?
Listen, all I could say is I really enjoyed the conversation. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, appreciate it. Well, that's a wrap on another great story to help us create, grow, and protect our wealth. Fellow risk takers, let's celebrate that today. We added one more person to our mission to help 1 million people reduce risk in their lives. This is your worst podcast host, Andrew Stott, saying, I'll see you on the upside.